Was there a particular story that you went through that really made you change the way that you think about money?
How deep y'all want to go?
as comfortable as you feel.
We got time.
We got time. And you know what? I got time today too, so I'm going to just tell it.
Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Kirsten.
And I'm Julian. And today we're having a conversation with Lynette Calfani Cox. Yes. Now, if you've been following us for a while, especially if you're a fan of Money on the Table season two, I believe it was episode two, we met up with Lynette, your mom, your aunt, and a few other people.
Yeah, husband Earl.
In Houston. And we gave her her flowers already, right? So we've already done that. We actually made her cry. We do not want to do that again. But she is without question deserving. She is amazing. She is a mentor to many. Us, Budgetnista, several other people, all of your faves all know who she is. You may not know who she is. So hopefully we can help solve that problem. She's done a lot of things. She's a New York Times bestseller. She is a speaker. She's a financial coach. She's
a real estate investor,
media journalist.
She's a mother.
All of the things. She understands money in a way that I think most people just don't. Which is why she wrote,
we're here to talk about our new book.
I'll start at the top. She is a New York Times bestseller. She is an author. She is a public speaker. She's a former media professional. She didn't even say former. She still does media.
Absolutely. But she's a mom.
She's all the things.
She's a real estate investor.
Been there, done
she's
that.
She's truly her. Yeah. Like, she is that girl.
She
like.
Really, really is. She really is. And she is also someone that has experienced a good bit of hard times. And so, as if there wasn't a nut for her to crack, she found something that was missing in the space, which is why we're speaking with her today about her new book, Bounce Back. So tune in for this conversation. It's going to be great. We're speaking with one of our favorite people, one of the most credible people in the personal finance space, about her new book.
Just did an intro before we hopped on here and told the people about our relationship and just how you really are her. That's what the kids say. Like, she's her. Like, you're just someone we look up to, and how excited we are to talk about your new book, baby, and this topic, which, you know, I'm surprised it hasn't been explored as much because it's such an important topic. And we're recording now, if you don't mind, just,
of course.
You know, we can hop. Well, now that I know that you're a professional, like, of course you're going to say,
run
of course, run with it. But like, this topic is so important, and I opened your book, and I just want to shout out the index, because like, I have never seen a more thorough index. After flipping through the first pages, the first like 10, 15 pages, like when you called it the ultimate guide to financial resilience, you meant it. Like everything is in this book. And I just want to know, like, why did you want to focus on resilience as a foundational element of financial literacy versus something more like objective and easily measured? Why resilience?
Well, the main reason is that in 20 plus years of doing this, of coaching people, talking to folks about their financial challenges, understanding what kind of like takes people out and gives them a 1-2 punch, is that I found that a lot of people have setbacks constantly.
Yeah.
So they don't just have one thing. Usually it's 1, 2, or 3 things simultaneously. And then for many folks, it's like, wow, this person went through a divorce last year. They got downsized this year. Oh my goodness, 2 years ago, they were dealing with medical debt. You know, so there are these perennial issues that a lot of people face. And unfortunately, nobody talks about how do you recover from that stuff? Mm-hmm. And not only how do you recover from it financially, but how do you recover from it emotionally? So I really wanted Bounce Back to be a story-driven book, a book that talks about people and how they've recovered, how they've achieved financial, emotional, physical, and social resilience, primarily focusing on the financial and the emotional, because I also know from my work, again, 2+ decades in now, that 80% of all financial decision making is emotional. You know, Nobel Prize winning economist Daniel Kahneman showed this in his work. And so I was like, we're giving people all of this advice, but we're not really talking as much about the personal and personal finances. And the personal is the stuff that's real. Oh my goodness, I'm in debt. Oh my goodness, I was discriminated against. Oh my goodness, my kid is sick or has a chronic, you know, condition. Oh my goodness, I went through a hurricane or a flood, a natural disaster, a fire. And now I'm still struggling because I haven't got my money from FEMA.
Yeah.
You know, so I wanted to focus on personal situations, and I wanted to look at the most common things that folks experience and say, we can talk about how you recover, and we can talk about planning for some of this stuff as well, and how you get to the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it a coincidence that all of the personal situations started with a D? I think that's just the coolest thing.
I call them all the dreaded D's, right? And they're dreadful, first of all, when you go through them. And yes, after a while, I was like, oh, there's some alliteration up in here. I'm going to go with it, you know? But it was honestly, you know, coincidental. And, you know, I think on when I was chatting with Tiffany, everybody out there should know Tiffany Alice, the Budgetnista. I was chatting with her for a live, and I was talking about, you know, how life be lifing. And really, a lot of things in life that set you back just coincidentally start with the D. Downsizing from a job, again, divorce, death of a loved one, disability, disease, natural disasters, debt, damaged credit, and then what I call dollar deficits. You know it as living paycheck to paycheck. You know, I don't have any cash flow, I'm broke. Yeah. And then the last one, discrimination. Mm-hmm. So these 10 dreaded D's, as I looked back over my own life, I realized, wow, girl, you've been in the trenches, because you've been through 9 of the 10 dreaded D's and you've successfully overcome them. And so, of course, I wanted to share my own story and weave that into the book as well.
I want to pivot just for a second, and this may or may not make the final cut, but I want to pivot because the timing of this conversation is really interesting. Just this morning, I was watching this interview with Robin Roberts and Jennifer Lewis. Have you seen that interview?
I didn't see it yet. What happened?
Okay. So in the interview, Jennifer Lewis is sharing a major setback. Basically, she, after Black-ish was, had wrapped, she decided to take some time, take a break. She took a vacation in Africa. She was somewhere in the Serengeti preparing for a safari the next day. She had a tragic accident, and we're all just learning about this a year later. She fell about 10 feet, came very frighteningly close to death. And now, after rehab, after all of the scares, after keeping all of this under wrap, she is basically telling her story and encouraging people to get up. And so as we're talking about who you are and what you represent to so many of us in the space and your book being Bounced Back, or Jennifer Lewis sharing her own version of this story, and very similarly, her being the Black mother of Hollywood and then thinking about the role that you play, it's like really interesting that all of these things are kind of coming together. But along those lines, that story was like scary. And you said in your book, you share some personal stories. Was there a particular story that you went through of these particular deeds that really made you change the way that you think about money?
How deep y'all want to go?
as comfortable as you feel.
We got time.
We got time. And you know what? I got time today too. So I'm going to just tell it.
Yeah.
I guess I would highlight both going through a divorce and downsizing. So in Bounce Back, this is the first time that I kind of fully shared my divorce story and fully shared what it was like and how I got downsized and sort of why. And I just put it all out there. So I was like, hey, the truth is the truth, you know? So, and I guess I'm highlighting these two stories because they were both, you know, certainly things that affected me financially, but that also affected me, of course, emotionally, right? By far and away, the thing that affected me emotionally the most was losing my sister, Debbie, beyond a shadow of a doubt. The hardest thing that I've gone through, the most gut-wrenching. I mean, like, when my other sister, my oldest sister, Cheryl, told me over the phone, I literally started screaming and just threw the phone. Yeah. My kids, I was sitting at the dining room table, and my children were like, I freaked them out, of course, because they were like, what? And then my son just started crying. He didn't even know what the problem was, but he just had never seen me freak out. I just couldn't accept it. I just was so beyond over, just done. And for months afterwards, couldn't get out the bed, couldn't function. So, you know, at an emotional level, that was absolutely the hardest. It's been almost 10 years since my sister passed away. She died December 30th, 2014. And I think back on Debbie's life now more than I do her death. I think back with fondness of about her. Her birthday was just the other day, March 11th. She would have been 59 years old. She died at age 49. And she had an 11-year-old daughter. So, you know, a lot, you know, in that, because I know a lot of people struggle to bounce back from the death of a loved one. In my case, it didn't affect me financially on that side because my sister had done so many things right. She had life insurance, she had property, she had a will, she had, you know, she had really her stuff together. The other two, going through divorce and then being downsized from my job as a Wall Street Journal reporter for CNBC, certainly those two were traumatizing. So just the high-level version is, in my marriage, I was the primary breadwinner. In fact, I was the sole breadwinner. My ex-husband was a student. He was getting his PhD from Penn. And all of what we kind of thought and expected didn't turn out to be, obviously, what we thought and expected. He was supposed to be in a PhD program for 5 years. 5 years went to six, then seven, then eight, then nine, then 10, then 11 long years. Wow. I'm putting the emphasis on that for a reason. Everything got shifted. You know, I, again, was the sole breadwinner. I think that there were issues around that. Obviously, you know, from a gender role expectations, all of that power, balance, control issues emerged. And of course, financial issues emerged. We racked up debt together, et cetera. We had two kids. And so when I divorced, I was the payer. Okay, so a lot of people think like, oh, the woman is always going to receive. No, I'm here to tell you, I was shelling out a lot of money. Mm. It was like $66.50 a month in the beginning, you know. It was a lot because, again, I was earning a six-figure salary and he had not, you know, any income at the time. He did finish his PhD. He did get a job, but I still paid for, you know, 5 or 6 years. And I paid, you know, an amount that decreased every year. And the last year was like $1,200 a month. It was alimony and child support. So, I tell the story in that, and I tell sort of why we divorced. You know, the long and short of it was a high level of incompatibility. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it was, you know, all love and all good at first. And it was until it wasn't, you know. Mm-hmm. But I was young and I count many things that I did early, in my 20s. I say, you know, that was my young and dumb phase, you know, I was thinking like, oh, love is enough. And, you know, I respect this person. He's, you know, very active in the community. He's very Afrocentric, which was appealed to me. He was kind of a workaholic type, which also appealed to me. But I didn't think about what that meant for me as a wife. That I would effectively have an absentee husband, that he would be constantly in the community doing stuff, and he would be constantly working in a way that we had a shift. And then I would start working, of course. And his work was, again, you know, being a student, but then doing civic engagement, community activities. And again, we kind of drifted apart. And, you know, again, I talk about the financial, the problems, you know, at every level. So that cost me dearly for many years, you know, again, paying. And the thing that I highlight and bounce back is that even though I had a divorce decree, which basically said, I agree to pay, and I don't want anything from you. I'm going to pay for, you know, this, you know, amount of time. And I had to go to court ultimately to get a stop to my alimony and child support. By this time, we had both remarried. He had two other kids. I had one kid. And I was like, why am I still underwriting his lifestyle? You know? Right. And so, I went to court. The judge ruled in my favor. The, child support stopped. Right. And, it got to a point where not only was I recognizing that I had been a financial enabler, through all of that marriage, it was my sister Debbie who told me, one time I was complaining to her, and I said, why is he trying to bleed me dry? Why is he milking me? He just, you know, like, he's a professor now. He's at a college. He has a wife. She works. He got his own thing. Why he need my money? And, you know, why is he trying to take advantage of me? And she was like, he's not, Lynette. He's not at all. He's merely asking you to maintain the status quo. Mm-hmm. She said, you went into a marriage where a year after you got married, you moved from LA to Philadelphia so he could do his PhD program. You said, oh, I'm gonna put on my black woman, superwoman cape. And yeah, don't worry about it. I got you. I'll work not one, but two jobs. I work for the Philadelphia Inquirer by day. And I work for the 10 o'clock news in Philadelphia, the Fox affiliate by night. And you were like, okay, bet, I got you. For 5 years, we'll do this. You go ahead, just get the PhD, and I'll just work. And like I said, the 5 years went to 11 years. And during all that time, he didn't work, but I enabled. I kept it going. I was like, okay, I'm be a good little wifey here. You know, I'm going to keep it, you know. No, okay, yeah. His mama, not my mama, his mama, like about 8 years in, she was like, no, this ain't right. She was like, he need to get a job. He need to work. Okay. Not my mother, his mother. But again, I was like, oh, I'm going to be supportive. It would be positive if I just said no, if I pulled back, if I insisted, you know. When I reflected and look back, I did that with multiple relationships. Mm. You know, my first boyfriend, the boyfriend I had in college, and him, you know, who I met while I was in college and ultimately married right after college. So, yeah, I had to look at my own actions and behaviors, you know. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I talk about in Bounce Back and in the Bounce Back workbook, when people are going through things like grief and processing what I call ancillary losses, this is what the term is called. In addition to the personal loss, the financial loss, there are other losses that you suffer when you lose a loved one, when you go through a divorce, etc. I had to work through a lot of that. I had to process that and unpack that and, again, own my own stuff. So in the Bounce Back workbook, which is the companion to Bounce Back, the Ultimate Guide to Financial Resilience, I give people exercises so they can reflect, fill in the blank, do quizzes, self-assessments, and, again, see your own stuff, because it's only with clarity later that you can see it, you know. My downsizing, I should have seen it coming. The handwriting was on the wall.
Yeah.
I got a pink slip, and it was not fun. I ran through my six-figure 401k in the aftermath. I made some financial mistakes. But, yes, I did indeed recover. And I do have, in part, I have my husband, Earl, my forever husband, you know, now. Sometimes I'll say, oh, my second husband. He's like, stop saying second. People might think you're going on, what, you going to number three? I'm like, absolutely not. I'm good now. It's perfect, you know. So it ain't perfect, you know. Nobody's perfect.
I know what you mean.
He's perfect for me. So, yes. Yeah. So
that's
anyway.
That is the perfect segue. I love that story. One, because I just talked to a psychotherapist about perfectionism a couple of weeks ago, and one of the ways that perfectionism manifests in women is with these idealized standards for our relationships and like these appearing perfect in our relationships, always saying yes. And there is a point where it becomes, you know, maladaptive, it becomes unhealthy. And then I heard the CEO of NVIDIA on a panel recently, and he said something along the lines of, if you have really high expectations, you usually have really low resilience. He was trying to make the connection that if you have this habit of setting unrealistic expectations, it almost erodes your ability to build resilience because you're so destroyed every time. And so when you bring up the workbook, I was so happy that you created it because to me, workbooks enrich a reading experience in a way that almost nothing else can, like other than a book club or reading alongside with a group or, you know, doing it with your partner or something. There's something about a workbook and their self-reflection and the introspection that allows your expectations to stay in check.
Yeah.
Like you're saying bounce back, but it's not immediate. Like it's not instant. You're not going right back to where you quote unquote fell from. There's a process that has to be worked through and it can get messy. It can, cause you gotta do some unlearning. There's some accountability in there. Why did you think it was important to create the workbook? Was that intuitive or, you know, did the publisher ask for it after reading it?
The publisher did ask for it, but I actually wrote both books simultaneously, believe it or not. So they didn't, when I tell you like, talk about unreasonably high standards. No.
You just stay ready. That's all that is.
I'm so serious because in the middle of writing Bounce Back and the Bounce Back workbook, I realized, I was like, oh my God, I've done this to myself again. The very thing that therapists told me in the book, you know, advice that, friends like Sandra Davis, who's a master coach and a financial expert, shared with me about not having compassion for yourself, not having self-care. I was doing all of that. So let me tell you what happened. This is a crazy story. I mean, this is really bonkers here. I signed the deal with Wiley, the publisher, Wiley and Sons, to write Bounce Back and the Bounce Back workbook in January 2023. I agreed to a 6-month deadline.
Ooh.
To write not one, but two books.
Two okay? big books, by the way.
Two big books, okay? Who in the world does that? Like, I look back, I'm like, I don't even know what I was thinking, okay? When I tell you, this took everything out of me. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I have a 6-month deadline. Here's what happened. And again, I'm gonna keep it 100. I'm gonna be real honest here. You know, my husband, Earl, is my agent and business manager. He negotiated our deal. We got a nice deal. I was like, oh, I'm so happy. I'm gonna write these two books. Well, they were supposed to pay on, like literally on signing or, you know, soon thereafter. But it was something with their AP department or something happened or, you know, it was something along the lines that they had a hold up with that check. And y'all know me. Y'all know me.
Baby, what you owe me?
I was like, I ain't lifting a finger. Send that check. You better send that check first because then I will commence to write it because I got other stuff that I'm being paid for. And no. So around mid-February or so, it might have even been the end of February. We got the check, okay? The first check, the first half for both books. I was like, great, let me, okay, now I'll start writing. Well, March, I had like other stuff. I had deadlines, I had this and that. So really it was about like the end of March that I was like, oh Lord, I gotta write some books here. I gotta get to writing. That I started writing in earnest. Now I had already had the outline for the book. I had already given them a proposal. I had already had the concept for Bounce Back. This has been years in the making in my head because I talked about this concept before. So I had the structure of the book already written for the main book. But here's what happened. I'm writing. I'm writing. I'm like, oh my God, this is a lot of work. I'm interviewing people. I'm getting the stuff. Then I'm working on the workbook also. Now it's getting about a month out and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm looking at the workbook. I'm like, I'm not even close. I'm really stressed out about it. Then about a week before my deadline, Earl says, Lynette, you know, you're stressing so much about this. Why don't you just let me ask for an extension? And I'm like, absolutely not. I said, no, I will meet this day. I was like, I don't care if I have to pull all-nighters, which I'm not good at because I get tired. And then next morning you look at what you wrote and you're like, that don't even look right, girl. You know? So I said, no. I was like, nope, I will not get an extension. So he was like, okay, babe, but you know, this is common in publishing. They, you know, they build some of this into the schedule. You can, it's okay. You know, I was like, no, my husband goes out. He goes to like Target or something. I'm in my living room and I am sitting on the sofa. I'm about to cry. I'm just getting overwhelmed. I just get on my knees and I start praying. I said, God, help me. Please, I don't know how I'm going to finish this book in time, let alone two books. Help me to figure this out. You know, please just help my ideas to flow. Help my everything, right? I get up and I start walking into the bathroom and I say to myself, I say, oh, please, God, help me. I said, because I cannot fail. I use the bathroom. I come out of the bathroom. As soon as I'm walking out of the bathroom, I promise you, a voice in my head said, you're not a failure. If you don't turn that book in on June 30th, you're not a failure.
Yeah.
Hey, they're going to get the book when they get it. If it's a month later, if it's a week later, that don't mean you're a failure, girl. You know? So I was like, okay, yeah. I was like, Lynette, you know what? You're putting too much pressure on yourself. Yeah. So basically, Earl came back home. I said, honey, you know what? I thought about it. I do want an extension. I said, not for bounce back. I will turn that book in on June 30th, my deadline. I said, but for the bounce back workbook, just give me a 1 week extension and I'm gonna get this done. He looked at me. He said, he was like, girl, he was like, he didn't say girl, but he was giving me that look like girl.
Yeah.
He
said, a week? Lynette.
He said, let's be realistic. He said, we're going to Essence. You know, we have a client commitment with TIAA. You're going to be on the floor every day from June 30th, July 1st, July 2nd. He was like, a week is not going to be enough time. We're going into July 4th weekend. He was like, no. He said, let me ask for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. And I said, okay, you're right. I said, how about 2 weeks? Just 2 weeks. So, my Essence experience, this shows you how much I'm packing in my schedule. I'm on the floor June 30th at Essence all day long. I leave at 8:30 for my hotel. I'm there till 5:30. My feet are killing me, okay? At the end of the day, I'm like, I gotta go get some shoes. We stop in a store, we get shoes. We get back to the hotel at 6:30. At 6:30, a notary public arrives at my hotel. Because I'm buying a property in the Atlanta area. And the closing is also June 30th.
Oh my goodness.
So I'm signing documents from like 6:30 to 7:30. I come back in the hotel room. I'm like, now I've got concert tickets to see one of my three top all-time performers, Lauryn Hill. Thank you very much, TIAA. They gave us four seats, you know, the whole VIP package. Lauryn Hill, y'all. Okay, Lauryn Hill. So at 8 o'clock, Earl says, what would you like to do? This is all he says to me. He says, you know, we can switch. We can pivot here. I see you're up now. He said, I know your deadline is tonight at midnight. He said, do you want to go to the concert still, which is what our plan was? Or do you want to finish your book? What would you like to do? And I was like, I can't be irresponsible. Child, I pushed that button on that book. I have to look back at the email. It was either 11:57 or 11:59.
Wow.
I had the email, I had the message to them, the attachment. I uploaded the document in there and said, hi, team, you know, attached, you know, here's the book, bounce back, you know, let me know if you have any questions, best Lynette. And wow. I just barely met my deadline. Wow. I'm saying all that to say, the amount of pressure and stress and perfectionism that we put on ourselves, I realized it, you know, when I was in it later, and I was like, I will never in life commit to 2 books at a time. In fact, I'm not going to say it, but I have a whole different thing for how I'm going to do any, if it's Wiley or any other publisher, it's going to be on my schedule. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Building your resilience is not only, you know, taking care of yourself physically and emotionally. If you don't have the right connections, if you don't have the right support, the right people in place, bouncing back from any setback, whether it's a self-inflicted wound or otherwise, is much, much harder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to stay on that for a second because, you know, this is the ultimate guide to financial resilience. It is ultimate, to Kirsten's point. But you spend the first 2 chapters really focusing on mental health and self-compassion, right? Why did you make that decision?
I really wanted to emphasize to people that you must take care of your mental and emotional health first in order to take care of your financial well-being.
That's it.
All too often when something bad happens to us, like a job loss, our instinct is, oh, I want to run out and get another job. I have to replace my income. Or I'm divorced and, you know, now I have to, you know, find another house or not. Or am I going to get another partner? Right? The tendency is to try to leap back into something before we've emotionally processed the thing that has happened to us. And so in those first couple of chapters, part of what I help, or part of what I hope to help people understand is the difference between change and transition. So change is often sudden. It's when something happens to you and it's external. But transition is internal. It happens within you and that takes time. Hmm. Very often weeks, months, or mostly for a lot of things, years to really process and unpack. And so I wanted people to understand that if you're still struggling with something, if you're like, yeah, somebody's telling you, well, you should get over it. You got divorced. That was like 2 or 3 years ago. Dang, move on with your life. No, there's no time limit and there's no right or wrong time. You may still be emotionally processing and unpacking stuff years later. In my case, when I divorced, not only did I have to recognize my own culpability, the things that I did right and wrong in my marriage, the stuff that I was doing to be a financial enabler. But I also realized the ways in which my decisions, the financial choices that I made in the immediate aftermath of my separation and divorce, they cost me for years. They cost mm-hmm. me up until my kids went to college. And when I remarried, my kids were like about 6 and 4 years old, right? My kids are now 26 and 24 years old. So here we are 20 years later, right? I was divorced at that age. They were maybe 7 or 8 when Earl and I got married, right? We're going to year 18 of our marriage. So here's my point though. Even though I didn't ask my husband for a dime, I agreed to be the payer. The one thing that I asked him for, I said, when our kids are of age to go to college, I want us to split the cost of their higher education. We both agree that getting a degree was important. We both, again, he had a PhD, Ivy League graduate. I have a master's degree in journalism from USC. We both shared those values. He said, absolutely, of course, not a problem. That's the only thing that I asked him for. But what happened? By the time our kids got to be college age, he balked. He reneged on that agreement. And he said, she want to go out of state. I can't afford that. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. So we and both of our kids went out of state. My daughter, Aziza, wound up going to University of Texas at Austin. She did phenomenally well there. Our son went to North Carolina State University. He did great there. So they both went out of state from New Jersey, right? And he didn't want to pay. So I had to go back to court. Not once, not two times, three, four, five wow. court orders. Wow. And ultimately get something called a quadro, a qualified domestic relations order, to tap his retirement account in order to pay, because they went to college. My daughter graduated from college. My son went to college. He was a senior. I didn't get my money that I was owed, the last $36,000 of it, till about a year and a half ago. And my son graduated in December 2022. Wow. So I'm telling you that your choices and decisions that you make emotionally.
Yes.
If you're not in your right mind, and I was not in my right front. I had not processed or unpacked everything, but I was making choices. I was like, okay, because I wanted my freedom, I was like, I'll pay whatever it takes. I just wanted to pay to get my freedom. But you know what? You were paying a lot more than you should have, and you paid a lot longer, and you paid in other ways, emotionally distressed, dealing with divorce and court. And so it was a lot.
Mm. Yeah. Is there a specific tactic or like a mental health, you know, I don't call it a tip, but like a tactic is probably what I'm thinking of. But is there a specific mental health tactic that you think people should be mindful of that might be in a situation that they need to bounce back from that was helpful for you?
Yes. So I would highlight two or three strategies. One is journaling. Writing things down really lets you see things with clarity and to go back and look at it later and to reflect on it. So journaling is absolutely a good practice. It's also a good form of self-care because it means you're taking time to pause, to think about things, to reflect, and to get in touch with your feelings and your emotions. Because journaling doesn't just have to be about what happened. Journaling can be about how did I feel? And again, in the Bounce Back Workbook, I give people different types of journaling exercises. One to do, just do free form, just flow, whatever comes to your mind, whatever words or whatever thoughts, whatever emotions come to mind. And then in other cases, you will write about the actual experience, what you went through, and document what happened. So journaling is one of those. There's also grounding exercises that people can do. And again, hats off to my friend and mentor, Sandra Davis, who walked me through a number of exercises that people can do, some of which relate to literally like stopping and counting. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, recognizing like 5 things that you can see or 4 things that you can smell, 3 things that you might hear, and so forth. Or exercises where you kind of get in touch with yourself by listening. So you listen, for example, I'm in an office right now. I did hear my dog whine, right? But you might listen for sounds and things that are immediate. Like I might hear room tone in my room here. Then I hear, oh, the gardener is outside cutting grass. Then I hear a car far away. Then, you know what? I heard an airplane way up above in the sky. But those things are centering for you and they're grounding, you know? So there are a number of things on the self-care front. Now, it can be I take a hot bath or a bubble bath. It could be that I go outside and I take a walk. It could be that I recognize the things that are in nature, or I just sit around in my house and I play music and I dance, you know, to Beyonce, whatever it is your jam, right? But all of these things that are a form of self-care, they actually do build resilience. And so I showed the connections for those in both Bounce Back and the Bounce Back Workbook.
I love that. I think the internal environment is so important. Like we stress it a lot. But the external environment is also really important. And I know that you've mentioned it a couple of times just in our conversation today, but also in the book, you talk about community support and that being a really vital part of building your resilience. And I think one of the interesting parts about the D's, maybe not interesting, but one of the things that I've noticed is that when you're experiencing these D's, whether it's debt or divorce or even disability or discrimination, there's a lot of shame involved and people tend to self-isolate. We, you know, say as a community, closed mouth don't get fed.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to ask for help in a lot of these situations. It's just very difficult to find the words or the courage to ask people for help. Some of the ways that we've coached people unconventionally to get help is doing things like, okay, well, just start by listening to coaching or listen to some podcasts so you can hear other people and know that you're not alone. Or, you know, Julian might say, you might not need to add anybody to your circle. You just need to remove people from your circle. Are there any unconventional ways that you teach people to overcome the shame and actually get the help that they need, or the perfectionism or whatever it is that's holding them back from accepting the help or asking for it? Is there anything that you've come across in your time with other people that could be helpful to the audience?
Yes, I would highlight a couple of things. First, one that Sandra shared with me. So it was about self-compassion. And so we often tell people, you know, practice self-care, be kind to yourself, you know, have self-compassion. Don't speak too harshly to yourself. And she made me realize that it's hard for people when you've been critical, when you've been a perfectionist, and if you don't achieve your standards, you're hard on yourself. And there's a lot of negative self-talk that goes along with that. Like, dang, why did I mess up? Or how come I couldn't pull that off? Or, oh, I failed again. Or, you know, some negative element kind of takes over in our mindset. And sometimes that, of course, dictates our behavior. But what she made me realize is that self-compassion is often easier to practice when you do it externally on others.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, Kirsten, if I was talking to you and if you told me you did something that you felt bad about, what would I do? If you said, oh my gosh, say something with your son, with Beau, and you said, you know, he was crying for me, girl, and I was just like, I can't get out. I'm just going to let him cry. And I just let him cry for 2 minutes. And I really should have went to him faster. And I'm just making something up, right?
Yeah.
What I would say to you as a friend is, girl, when you get yourself together, when you are centered and have your peace of mind, you're able to be a better mommy. So sometimes it's okay to let him self-soothe or to, you know, understand that, okay, yeah, I fell down or whatever his issue was, or mm-hmm. I don't have my Legos blocks or whatever it is. But he'll be okay. Like, it's okay for you to take a moment with yourself and get yourself ready then to go in there to deal with him. In other words, I would speak to you kindly, right? But you might say to yourself, oh my God, I'm the worst mother in the world. How could I let my son, you know, cry for 2 minutes without me going to talk to him? So as somebody who is trying to practice self-care and kindness to oneself, Sandra's advice was think about what you would say to a friend. Like, what would you say to a friend who was experiencing the same thing? And now say that same type of thing to yourself, right? So it's the same thing if you're going to write a letter to yourself about an experience that you had or something that you're struggling with. Write it as if you were saying it to a friend. Mm-hmm. And then that's the way that people can kind of get to that more kind state, you know, for themselves, certainly. Now, when it comes to actually asking for help, this is something that's very, very key. So, and I talk about this, of course, in Bounce Back, that yes, one of the most important factors in building your resilience is connection at every level. I don't care what you're going through. If you've been through discrimination, if you've been through a downsizing, loss of a parent or a child or a spouse, divorce, etc., having the right people in your corner. And sometimes even if it's on the financial side, if you've been through debt, damaged credit or dollar deficits, having a budget counselor, a CPA, an accountant, an investment advisor, having those people who know more than you know, or who've experienced something, or who can even be a shoulder for you to cry on or somebody to lean on and talk to is always helpful when you have the right people in your corner. So those connections absolutely help you. But here's the disconnect, and this is what I found. a lot of us have million-dollar networks. Now, you know, we say the expression, you know, your network is your net worth kind of thing,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
We have the people, but the disconnect is in our ability to go ask. Mm-hmm. So we can get to that first step, like, okay, I'm going to build connections, or I have connections, or I'm going to nurture connections. But then it's like, ooh, to ask. Again, myself, I did this even with Bounce Back. I was like, oh, okay, I have all these friends in the media. I have people who have great platforms. I was like, I got to ask. I got to go say, oh, here, can we get on the show? Can we get on, you know, kind of thing. And I was like, I had to say, like, why is it that you struggle with that? Why is it that you don't want to ask? And it's because we have all been ingrained in this culture with an individualistic mindset, self-sufficiency, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, do it on your own, gut it out, you know, the grit level, right? Which is different than resilience, right? Which is to say, I could do this on my own. Or mm-hmm. or even when we're struggling, the mindset is, I made my bed, I got to lie in it. Or I got myself into this mess, I got to get myself out. No, you don't. You can have help to get out of that bed, okay?
That's it.
So the one thing I would share with the audience is to recognize you don't have to suffer in silence. And at the end of the day, anytime you're feeling shame, guilt, or any kind of a negative emotion, that it's actually a clue or a red flag for you that that's the time that you need to ask for help. Because you're working in isolation. You're working in a vacuum. You're by yourself. And there's a reason they say two heads are better than one. There's a reason the Bible says a wise man has a multitude of counselors. It's because you need that outside perspective. So I would just offer to your audience that the best thing to do is when you start to think like, ooh, I don't want to tell somebody about this, or I don't want to share, or I don't want to ask for help, that's precisely the time when you need to do it. And yes, you know, Martin Luther King said, you don't have to see the whole staircase, just take the first step, you know?
Right.
The first step is just opening the door to that conversation.
I love it.
I need some help with this, or here's something I'm going through. Can I talk to you about this? And once you say those words, I'm telling you, the other person's going to listen, be empathetic, and they're probably going to tell you their same story and what they've been through as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you're making me think about experiences that I've had. You know, I know you use the word resilience, but, you know, I also think about it as just a matter of being resourceful. And even mm-hmm. still, there are times where you have the resources, you have the community, you have the people, but you still pause or hesitate or just avoid seeking help. We deal with trying to help people to overcome that as well. Not too long ago, we were doing a talk with for an organization, and we were talking about home ownership, and we were really just reminding people that you don't have to do this on your own. There are tons of programs and nonprofit organizations that are out there that are trying to help people like you make that dream of becoming a homeowner come true. And we know that there are several other financial challenges or obstacles that people have in their lives. But going back to what we were just saying, there oftentimes tends to be like a bit of a challenge there, a bit of a blockage, if you will, in terms of people going out to seek the help that they really need. At the end of every chapter, you kind of offer and remind people that, hey, these organizations exist and like they're there to help and they do a pretty good job. Is there a particular organization or group or resource that you think is probably one of the best kept secrets, but just something that is out there that can really help people that have been down on their luck a little bit?
Oh, that's a great question. So you're right that every chapter of Bounce Back features 10 organizations that I highlight to talk about resilience and having the capacity to kind of bounce back. I guess if I were to highlight a couple, I would probably say in the natural disaster category. Again, because so many folks go through floods, tornadoes, fires, earthquakes, you know, and I don't know how some people can't believe that climate change isn't real, but, you know, we're seeing that, unfortunately, this is one of those perennial things that are happening. I happen to live in the greater Houston area, and we moved here obviously subsequent to Hurricane Harvey, but there's still some folks who are trying to bounce back from Hurricane Harvey. So the American Red Cross is one great organization, and another lesser known organization called Team Rubicon is another great one for anybody who has lost a home or has been displaced. They are an organization that jumps right in there and helps people to recover. And so I share some of their resources and the stuff that they provide for people who have been through natural disasters, which are absolutely a dreaded D that people face. And sometimes they get forgotten and kind of left behind because people are like, oh, well, Hurricane Sandy, that was a long time ago. Or this, yeah. Or this, you know, those wildfires that happened in Hawaii. But yeah, people are still struggling to come back from that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the resources is such an incredible add to the book because, you know, it's you forget, right? You forget the things that your taxes pay for. You forget that there are grassroots organizations and whole structures that are committed to solving a lot of the problems that we experience in our lives. And yes, they're imperfect, but they can certainly give you a leg up when you're down on hard times. And, you know, it requires some stamina. I think anybody who's dealt with any of these organizations knows it can be inefficient. You gotta pick up the phone, you gotta wait, talk to a representative, fill out the form, keep track of everything. But to do it is to take advantage of something that a lot of people don't. And I think that's part of building your resilience and your resourcefulness is that you try everything. You try the stuff until you figure out what works.
I'll also add to that I think that there's something to be said for making a blanket assumption that most of these organizations are overwhelmed, right? There are several who have more than they need, and they can't wait for someone to give them a call, right? So you might have had that experience where, yes, you know, things were moving a little bit slowly, but we work with nonprofits pretty regularly, and every now and then you run into a couple that was like, yeah, we've got the help, we've got the resources, yeah. But we really just need someone to fill out the form. We'd be ready to jump in. You submit the form at 1 o'clock today, and at 1:05 you'd be on the phone with someone like, oh my gosh, thank you, I've been waiting by the phone for someone like you. So no, I think this is great.
Yeah, I interviewed a natural disaster recovery expert named Chris Burt for Bounce Back, who he has 35 years experience working for FEMA, Red Cross, local, state, and national organizations, and not just on disaster recovery, but on public health. And his focus also has largely been financial inclusion and equity, because he knows that Black and Brown communities typically don't recover as fast, typically don't get the same level of resources. So he gave me a lot of great advice in the book about dealing with insurance companies, dealing with FEMA, dealing with Red Cross, stuff you can get cash from the Red Cross, how they can give you a debit card, you know, like, you know, on the spot, you know, and people just don't know these things. And so, yes, the resources are out there. But you know, sometimes the access and the knowledge to get to them, is lacking.
Yeah.
All right. This is our last question. And I don't know, it's a bit of a trick question. It's not really a trick question. It's like picking a favorite kid. But, you know, one of the reasons that we love you and look up to you so much is because you lead by example. Despite all of your success, you are still showing us through your content, through your actions, through how you raise your children and live your life, that budgeting and saving and debt management are all still very practical strategies that you apply. It's not like you're out here, you know, balling out all the time. Like it's still a thing in your life. And I'm just curious if you have a favorite, like, do you have a favorite kind of low key money management skill that sets the tone for your mindset and all the other wins that you have? I feel like I know the answer, but do you have a favorite tactic or strategy that you just, it's your go-to?
Great question. And I guess I would say that we've adopted what we call a zero debt mindset.
I knew you were going to say that. So, I knew it was going to be debt. I just did.
Yeah. There's so much, you know, in this country, we have such massive amounts of debt. And obviously, you know, my book, Zero Debt, is a New York Times bestseller.
Yes.
The third edition of that. We're going to go to the fourth edition. Because
that's how I knew you were going to say it. I was like, I remember the story of how you wrote Zero Debt. Mm-hmm. You sold it at FinCon, I think. And yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, not at all. But, you know, we're up to $1.1 trillion in debt right now. We have $1.7 trillion in student loan debt. We have another $1 trillion plus in auto loan debt. Mortgage debt is, you know, $7 or $8 trillion. We're up to our ears in debt. So I think that for a lot of folks, they need to figure out savings strategies and ways to stop living paycheck to paycheck in order to address the debt and to be able to build their savings, which builds financial capacity and resilience. So, for us, we think, twice and then a third time before we borrow, right? So we are prudent about what we put on credit cards. We're prudent about what mortgages we take on. And you know, we're investors in real estate, et cetera. We own 8 properties. But even then, we're like, okay, you know, how are we going to manage this debt? What would happen if the tenants don't pay? That kind of thing. We try to be smart about that. And generally speaking, for several of our properties, we've made aggressive down payments, 40% down payments. So we have a lot of equity in our properties, et cetera. So the short answer is that we practice a zero debt mindset, because really, I don't want to owe anybody anything. I want to get to the point where all my properties are paid off, too, you know, and, you know, obviously keeping the credit card balances at zero. But I have learned that interest is, you know, did Einstein call interest? Well, like I forgot.
The eighth wonder of the world.
Eighth wonder of the world, right?
The compound.
It really is. I mean, because at the bottom line is that once you really understand interest, I tell people that you can be on one side of the equation or the other. You can pay interest for life as a debtor and as a borrower, as a, you know, somebody who owes, or you can collect interest for life as a saver and as an investor. I want to be on this side of the equation. I want to be collecting interest all the time. So very quickly, let me share with your audience a couple of, just one strategy on living paycheck to paycheck to stop that cycle. This relates to the dreaded D that I call dollar deficits, because people are broke, have no cash flow, they don't have savings, and then of course they resort to putting themselves into debt. So I'll share, I know you guys have a child, so I'll share something that'll help people to save money on childcare, on a cell phone, and on their credit cards. So I know y'all know childcare is a ridiculous amount of money. Mm-hmm. I call this strategy my switch and save strategy. So the idea is, take something that you're already spending money on. I'm not going to tell you to stop. I'm not going to tell you to scrimp. I'm not going to tell you to sacrifice. That ain't realistic. Most people are not going to, that's not sustainable. And human nature bucks against that. So instead of saying stop or scrimp or sacrifice, just switch. Just take something that you're already spending money on and switch to something more affordable that's cheaper, okay?
Yeah.
So some people who have kids, they might be spending, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 a year, $20,000 a year if they have, you know, daycare or a nanny, right? The switch is do a nanny share arrangement, right?
Yes.
I know your son is older now and is... how old is he now?
He's almost 7, yeah. But I was just talking to a mom at the bus stop about this in terms of summer camp, where it's like, let's team up. And if there's something that we can do and get a bulk discount, or, you know, we can share the commute, like, let's work together to try to keep these costs down, because it's crazy even at this age.
Yep. So, and it continues, you know, we'll have another thing. So we'll talk about the kids and the expenses on the kids, because I got 3 of them, as you know, 26, 24, and 18, and this is a lot. So in any event, the switch, though, is switch from full-time daycare or full-time nanny on your own to a nanny share arrangement where you partner with a local family, you share the same nanny at the same hours. 2 families, you'll cut your costs by 50%. 3 families, again, you know, if they have 1, 2, 3 kids, one each of you, you'll pay a third of the cost. So that's mm-hmm. one easy save, $5,000 or $10,000 or more a year you can save. I mentioned cell phones. We all have cell phones, and Americans buy a new cell phone every 2 years or so, $1,000 or so. And by the way, on that childcare front, just Facebook, you know, Facebook groups, Nextdoor, you know, get online locally, or just if you know your neighbors, just the resource to go to get that, right? On the cell phone front, instead of buying a $1,000 cell phone, if you're already broke, feeling like you have dollar deficits, living paycheck to paycheck, go from a postpaid phone to a prepaid phone. Straight Talk Wireless, again, another resource. You'll be able to get an affordable prepaid phone, a no contract plan, something cheap as $25 a month. Get your family plan. If you have, you know, parents and kids, you're going to save almost $1,000 in the course of a year on that. And then those credit cards that I mentioned. Again, if you have $10,000 in credit card debt, average rate is above 20%, but let's just say the interest rate is 20%. You're paying $2,000 a year just in interest.
Yeah.
The switch there is to switch from your high rate credit card to do a balance transfer to a 0% card that has 12 or 18 months on it. You keep paying on it, but you'll save yourself $2,000 in interest. Again, cardratings.com is a great resource on that front. They will, you know, they do reviews and ratings to show I'm an entrepreneur, I'm a student, I'm a, you know, I have excellent credit, I have good credit, so-so credit. They'll point you in the right direction to show you credit cards that'll be a right fit for you. So those three easy switches, but using the switch and save strategy to help you to save money. The more you can save, the more you can knock out that debt as well.
Amazing.
I love it.
Thank you so much for your time, for your wisdom, for all of the tips. If people want to find you to keep up or to buy Bounce Back, the ultimate guide to financial resilience, tell them where to go.
Yes. So Bounce Back is everywhere books are sold, online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your independent bookstore. You can go to your library and get it. If you don't want to buy it, you can check it out at a library, and certainly on our website as well, on our free financial advice site, which is askthemoneycoach.com. There's a link to it, as well as on my personal site, LynetteCalfanicox.com.
Amazing. Thank you, Lynette.
Thank you. We love you.
You're welcome. Thank you guys so much. I appreciate you both.